I'm back. They said keep coming back, right? My name is Chip, and I'm an alcoholic. And again, I give honor to my higher power to be here today. Thanks, Lauren, and thanks to the fellowship here for inviting me to come. As my sponsor said years ago, when someone asks you to participate in a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or anything that's saving your ass today, say yes. And yes, it is. So here I am once again. My name is Chip, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 20th, year 2000. So I got sober now 21 years. Never thought that would happen, but it did. I started off my drinking career at an age of 21. My dad and my mother, I have one sibling. They don't drink. I wasn't raised around alcohol. When my father saw someone that was less fortunate than us on the side of the road, he would say, "Don't be that person. That's an alcoholic. Don't be that person, that homeless person. You never want to do that when you drink." So my perception of being an alcoholic was totally wrong. But I am an alcoholic. So I became an alcoholic at the age of 21. I'm a flight attendant. I work for Alaska Airlines now, and I'm freely to discuss that in the open forum that we're in. My first career as a flight attendant was with Pan American World Airways back in the 80s when I turned 21. And that's what introduced me to alcohol. And we were in Maui on a layover. It was New Year's Eve. And the crew said, "Do you drink?" I said, "No." They go, "You will now." And we had to get naked and run into the ocean for New Year's. So I got naked and ran into the ocean for New Year's, and we drank. Woke up the next morning with a terrifying hangover and very sick, and told myself I need to do it again. And I continued to do it again. So I was in New York City when I started this career of alcoholism, and never received a DUI, didn't get in trouble. The only time you got in trouble in New York is when you're telling the train conductor on the subway to make it go one way when you want it to go this way, and it's going this way. So I got a lot of police officers met the trains on most of my stops. They didn't take me to jail, but they just always just kicked me off the transit system in New York City. So I moved here in 1991, but when I became a flight attendant for Alaska, I just celebrated my 30th year with Alaska Airlines, and my husband just celebrated his 30th year with Alaska, and we celebrate our wedding anniversary on the 22nd of September for 30 years. So it's a 30 year this year for us. And that's because of the program and my honesty being with myself that I am an alcoholic today. So we moved here, moved to Federal Way, and Christopher and I, when we started talking, we had so many similarities with our DUIs, and I got three. I got the first one in 1992, living in Federal Way, and the police officer pulled me over, and he didn't give me a ticket, but he towed the car. And we have another car at the house, right? So he took me home, and I'm calling the Federal Way Police Department, asking them, "Where's the car? I just got a ticket, and the officer didn't tell me where he towed the car, and they didn't say it on a ticket." So I drove the other car to the police department. That's how I think when I'm drunk, to ask them, "Where was the car?" So as soon as I walked in, the gentleman who didn't arrest me but did stop me says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm trying to find out where my car is." And he says, "How'd you get here?" I said, "I drove that one." So clink, clink, that was my first arrest. And in Federal Way, Grainville Court is the court facility down in Federal Way. So I had to spend a night in jail. I got out, I had to go to court. And the judge looked at me and said, "Mr. Hessel, I'm going to give you a deferred prosecution. If you stay good for 2 years, and some of us may know what a deferred prosecution is, it'll be fine." But was I ready to stop? No. I continued drinking. And 30 days before that deferred prosecution was up, I got the second stop. So I had to go back to Grainville Court. And that judge looked at me and she told me, "If I see you in my courtroom again," this was 19 months, 20 months later, earlier, "I am going to throw you in jail." And she did just that. So now I get the first DUI, get the second one in 1994, and I didn't get the third one to the year 2000. So we had that similarity when we first started talking in our recoveries. On the last DUI, I didn't know the 19th of July, the year 2000, would be my last drunk, and I'm so thankful to know that I didn't know that was going to be my last drunk. But on that day, I was at the bar. We have now moved to Belltown, and I was in a bar and feeling sick. I've been through the house arrest, been to jail many a times, and you know, and I never thought sitting in a jail cell, getting drunk again and going back to a jail cell will be okay in my life. But this disease told me, it's all right. You've done it the first time. You could do it again, and you could do it again. And where was I ever comfortable in my life to know that that's okay? I'm not comfortable with that anymore. So what happens on this night, I'm at the bar, and I ordered this beverage, and I'm feeling like I'm going to be ill. Like, I haven't even drank anything yet. And I'm feeling like it's just going to come out. So my disease told me, take that first one. And I took that first one. And that first one led to many, which led to a third DUI and arrest. And every time I've got those arrests during my drinking career, my partner was never home. I always did it when he was gone. So every time he'd come home off a trip, I'm either in jail when I got the DUI and the car is impounded. So on that morning, I came to, the only thing I remember on that arrest, and I never had a blackout, but it was getting to that progression in my disease. And what I can remember during that night was the police officer giving me the field sobriety test. And they're telling her how to do it. So I'm thinking, I'm going to beat this because she's going to mess up. And I'm going to get out of this conviction of a third DUI. And she did it perfectly, of course. And so when I came to, the next morning, I thought about that. So I called my attorney, gave me a call. So I called my attorney and I said, listen, this officer did da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I need you to get me out of this. He already knew by the time I talked to him that I blew three times the limit. And he said, you know what? You're going to stay in there. And when you get out, we'll contact you. I said, no, I can't stay in here, man. You got to beat this. I'm going to pay you all this money. I've been paying you all this money on these other DUIs. No, you're going to stay in there. And we're going to take care of this when you get out. So I stayed in there for a week. A prosecutor came into my jail cell and said, Mr. Hessel, we're going to keep you. We're going to keep you for a year. You're not getting out. You've had three DUIs within a year period. And my whole world just fell. And I thought, what can I do? And so one of my cellmates, and every time I went to jail, I had to defend myself that I'm an alcoholic. I was like, dude, you don't belong in here. You don't act like you belong in jail. This is not you. I'm like, dude, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I drink. I come here. So I'm defending myself to be an alcoholic. It's kind of crazy. So one of my cellmates said, write a letter to the judge. Simply write a letter to the judge, asking for mercy. And I wrote that letter to that judge. And about 4 or 5 days later, the guard comes in and says, Hessel, roll it up. And if you've never been to jail, when they say roll it up, that means you're leaving, going somewhere else, or going out. It's your bedding. So he said, roll it up. So I said, what's going on? Am I going to the bigger house? Because I knew I was going for a year. He says, no, you could bail out pending a court date. And they're putting me in another tank to do that. And I thought, really? So move forward, the judge got my little letter. And she read it. And I don't know what I said in it. I couldn't even tell you what I wrote. And I prayed before I wrote it. And I got a chance to bail out. Now, Ross is gone. Back then, we had no money because I don't spend it all on attorneys and getting DUIs. So I'm a flight attendant for Alaska Airlines, as I mentioned before. I called Alaska Airlines Collect out of jail. And I've been there 10 years at this point. And they know me. And it was a collect call from Chip Hessel, King County Jail, and a secretary for in-flight hung up. And I called again. And Rebecca answered the second time. And she says, what's going on? I said, I'm in jail. I need help. I can't get out and Ross isn't home. And I don't know what to do. But I could leave if you guys could help me. She goes, we're going to get you out of there. So they sent a supervisor down from SeaTac to King County Jail to bail me out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they'd do it today, but they did it then. And they bailed me out. And when I got out, I called my attorney back and said, I bailed out. He says, go to a meeting, go to treatment, get involved with the Alcoholics Anonymous program, get yourself a sponsor, and get your life right, Mr. Hessel, so I can work with this with you. And I did just that. I got sober in Belltown. I'm probably the only person who ever got sober in Belltown, but I got sober in Belltown. And my first home group was Belltown AM. They still meet. Well, now they're not because of the current environment, but they're coming back, I hear. And so that started my journey. I checked myself into a Lakeside Milan up in Kirkland. And with that, I was in an outpatient program during those. It was a 2-year outpatient program on that first deferred. And it took me like 8 years to get out of that 2-year outpatient program because I kept drinking and drinking and drinking. And that was with Intercept down in Federal Way. So at this one, I called our 800 number for our insurance on the back of our employee card and said, I'm Chip, I'm a flight attendant, I need help, and I need to go to treatment. And they gave, back then, you talked about earlier about the phones, back then you didn't have cell phones that had GPS and all those, you could look up everything, Google wasn't around. You had yellow pages, paper pages. So I'm flipping, and they gave me Sundown, and they gave me Lakeside Violet. And I'm flipping through the pages, Ross and I are looking for the Sundown place, and we can't find it, but we find Lakeside Violet. Come to find out Sundown is in Eastern Washington, which is why we couldn't find it in the local pages for Seattle. So I called Lakeside Milam. They did the assessment. The 800 number that I called for the airline did an assessment as well. And they said, you don't seem suicidal, and you don't seem like you need to go to an inpatient. We'll put you an outpatient. Now, I had manipulated that already. And I said, no, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. So then when I called Lakeside Milam, they did the assessment over the phone and told me the same thing. They said, I want to put you in our outpatient program. I said, no, that's not going to work. And I'm being honest about what's going on in my life, not even knowing I'm being honest. As this book tells me later on page 30, I have my first step of recovery is being honest with yourself. And so I'm doing that, not even knowing I'm doing it. So we called Lakeside Milam. I go take the assessment and they say, you want to go to inpatient? I said, yes, I have to go to inpatient. I need to displace myself. I have to take care of me. And they said, well, we don't have a bed for about a week. And you don't seem suicidal. Will you be sober and good for a week? And I said, yeah, I could do that. So I went in, as we heard Christopher talk about earlier, into my treatment center sober for 1 week. And they put me in a detox for 24 hours because of insurance purposes. And I went on into Milam. So I get out of Lakeside Milam. While I'm in there, the week before going into Milam, I had what I call my spiritual awakening. Not awakening, a spiritual experience, we say. The awakening came at the 12th step. But the spiritual experience I had was my family was living here at the time. They now reside in Dallas, Texas. And my mother and sister called me and said, come go to church with us. And I'm not a church-going person. To this day, I'm still not a church-going person, but I'm a spiritual person to the fellowship here that's taught me that. And I said, okay, I'll go. So I went to this church, and no one knows me, but I'm walking in. I was like, hi, welcome. And I'm thinking, man, I told everybody about me, and then I'm an alcoholic, and I just got out of jail, and they're trying to be friendly with me, and I don't want nothing to do with y'all. So we're sitting in the congregation, and a pastor says, there's somebody going away for 30 days, and I want this person who's going away for 30 days to come to the altar for prayer. Now, I really think they told everybody about me because Lakeside Milam's 28 days in a wake up. He usually reads a biblical story to the children and they go to children's church. But this Sunday, it was different. And so I ran down there and my sister, I hear my sister telling my mother, thank God. And I ran down there. My mom went with me and I'm standing there. And the experience that I had at this altar, I'm just crying. I was raised in the South. I'm originally from, I'm born in Orlando, but raised in Dallas. And in Dallas, I went to a holiness church and all black people, right? And we speak in tongues and we shout. Only thing we don't have is snakes around our necks because we're scared of snakes. So I had this feeling that was instilled in me as a child with my belief system, something greater than myself. And I'm praying, I'm just, my arms up and I'm just crying and I'm asking God to just take this away from me. I can't do this anymore. And I'm just begging. And at the time I asked, please take it out of my head, my heart, and my stomach. And the exact same time I'm doing that, the gentleman who's praying over me, as well as other folks who are down at the altar, is touching me in my head, my heart, and my stomach. And I turned, if my mother, she lives in Dallas now, if she was here today, she'd tell you, I turned around and I looked at my mom. I said, Mom, I'm done. I'm done. It's gone. I don't have to do this anymore. And I haven't had a drink since. But so I go into Milam and I share the story. I'm in a purple group. I share the story with my group, and my counselor says, you know, tell a little bit about yourself. So I share with this story, and I said, I had this experience at church. I'm all this now. And I got challenged. That night, a gentleman knocked on my window when I'm studying for my studies. He knocks on my window. And he says, Chip, come outside. And he's a big, brutally-looking guy. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to get my butt kicked here in Lakeside Milam. I'm offending somebody. So I go outside. He says, you talk about you had this spiritual experience and your spirituality now. He goes, we have a prayer circle. We want you to be part of the prayer circle. Come pray with us. I said, sure. So there's five of us stood in this little circle and we're praying. We prayed individually. Then when it got to me, I just prayed like I normally pray. And they came up and says, you know how to pray. We need you to do this. Because the circle grew from five to all these people. And it was like 100 people going through. It was a revolving door. One goes out, one comes in. So it's like 100 people. So this circle kept growing. We couldn't do it individually because we were missing our time to go to bed. So they nominated me to be the prayer guy and pray for everybody. So I'm doing this and I'm getting tired. I'm getting overwhelmed. I'm lacking on my studies. And my counselor noticed it. And she says, what's going on with you? And I called my mother. I said, Mom, I remember Reverend Jones saying he's tired and he's worn out. I said, I feel this. And she goes, what are you doing? I said, I've got this prayer circle going. And she says, well, you know what to do, son. I said, what's that? She goes, pray for somebody to take over the prayer circle. And I did. So I prayed for someone to pray over the prayer circle. And a gentleman checked, Chris, his name's Chris, checked in the next day and says, hi, my name is Chris. And my dad's a pastor, and I heard, you have a prayer circle? I said, I don't have a prayer circle. I said, the group has a prayer circle. He goes, can I lead it? And I was 1 week from getting out. So that happened. I share that story because my spiritual experiences I've had in these 21 years, like many of us have probably had, have been so profound in my life that I know that my higher power is guiding me. And that's what I try to instill in the suspects that I'm blessed enough to have in my life, that I could say, this is how this works. It's all about your spirituality and your connection with a higher power. And that has been day one with me. Many things have happened in my life over these last 21 years that I didn't think could ever happen. And I got out of Milam. I go to court. And the judge sees me 3 months later. And she says, Mr. Hessel. I said, yes. She goes, something's different about you. I said, well, ma'am, I got all this paperwork. I go to meetings. I got a sponsor. I'm doing the steps. She goes, I'm going to take a chance on you. She goes, because the laws have changed in 2000, that they have to sentence you to a year. And that's why that prosecutor said that. She goes, I'm going to sentence you to a year, but I'm going to suspend all but 3 months. I'm not going to put you in a jail cell if you can find an ankle bracelet and find a job at Alaska Airlines that will keep you on the ground because you can't fly. So I went to Alaska, and my director said, I don't know what we're going to do, Chip, if I can't help you. So I prayed. The next day, I get a call from Alaska that says, do you know anything about computer systems? And of course, like a typical alcoholic I am, I don't know nothing about computer systems. But I told him, yeah, I know a lot about computer systems. So I walked into this position at Alaska Airlines as an automation clerk for flight attendants. We're changing over our trading, how we trade for our trips. And they trained me. So I'm in an ankle bracelet in the bottom of the D concourse at SeaTac, helping flight attendants who didn't know I was incarcerated at the time. Only one knew. I had a different AA ring I used to have before. It was a bigger one. And this flight attendant came into my office. Now I have an office and a secretary out of all this. And she says, you're an AA. I said, yeah, how do you know? She says, I see your ring. I said, yeah. And it was my first year of recovery. And we lived in Belltown still. We went up to Queen Anne. I used to have a bookstore in Queen Anne Hill and in a house. And Ross took me in there. We bought me a big book cover. We bought me the ring. We bought the ring and a necklace. And I said, Ross, can I get the big book cover? And he says, no, we can't afford that right now. Remember, you ain't working. You're not flying. You're working, but you're not making that salary anymore. So I said, okay. So that flight attendant who saw me, she says, she came back the next day after my year. And she says, don't open up this gift until you see that plane taxi away that I'm going on. And I opened it up, and it was a burgundy book cover for my book. Huh. Ross had bought me a CD, and back then, Destiny's Child had a song called Bootylicious. And I love that song. So I said, can you give me that CD? He bought just a single song. He didn't buy the whole CD. So my supervisor, who was training me at the time in Alaska for his automation job, gives me an envelope with a $25 gift certificate for Blockbusters, when that used to be around. And I went and got my CD. So then I get home, and my one-year coin, similar to my 24, the bronze coins that we get, my one-year coin, the Belltown AM gave me, similar to these coins, Belltown gave me a beautiful one-year coin. And I came home and I told Ross, I said, I can't take this coin. I'm going to lose it. It's too pretty, right? And I said, I want one like this. If I lose it, I can get one of these. I'm sure it's less expensive than the other one. Well, I get home and I check my mailbox and I have a card from Orange County, California. And I'm like, who's, and I know in Orange County, California. I don't know anybody in Orange County, California. And I open it up, and my husband's sister is 6 months ahead of me in her sobriety. She mailed me her bronze one-year coin. And I open up that card, and that coin falls on the ground. And these, I get emotional, folks, because these are the little things. They may be small to y'all, but they're huge in my life that I'm doing the right thing, that I have to wake up every morning and activate my recovery. I have to wake up every morning and know that it's not just Care Bears, Twinkle Toes, and Sprinkles all the time, but I have to understand it's much better than jail, institution, or death. And that's what I do now. And I have to live this one day at a time, because that's all I have. So I get this opportunity in 2019, before COVID. A friend of mine, and I'll close with this, a friend of mine came to me that goes to Lana Club. He says, "Chip, I have this guy that keeps calling me from my hometown, and he wants help." And I said, Alaska had just started flying to Albuquerque, New Mexico. I said, "Aren't you from Santa Fe?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "We fly to Albuquerque. Let's go see him. Let's take a trip, go down there and work with him and see what we can do." So we go, and so we get to the airport. We're sitting in the boarding area. And I asked him, I said, "Have you heard from this guy?" He goes, "No, he hasn't called me in about 2 or 3 weeks, Chip. It's not like him." The phone rings, and it's him. And he asks him, he goes to my friend, he says, "Where are you?" He goes, "I'm getting on a plane. Get ready to come see you." He goes, "What?" So we flew down. We go down there. My friend's dad has 40 years in a program. So we introduce AA back into this gentleman's life who's sober today. And they hear me share at one of the meetings. And one of my things I always thought would be so cool is to speak at an AA convention, right? So I'm like, that'd be kind of fun. So I come back to Seattle, and New Mexico's calling me saying, "We want you to be one of our keynote speakers at our AA state convention," which I was in 2019. And I'm sitting here looking at 3,000 people going, "Whoa, this is not what I was asking for, but this is cool." So I had a chance to do that. These promises come sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they do materialize, as we know, as we work for them. But I put a tagline on that: only when I'm ready to receive them. Because I think that promise should come now. I think that promise should have came last week. But my higher power says, "No, I'm the director. You are just the instrument, Chip." And that's been my prayer for 21 years, is, "God, use me as an instrument of recovery, an extension of your grace." And I woke up on that 18th year. And I know I wasn't close to it, but I close with this one. I woke up on the 18th year of my sobriety. I looked at my husband. I said, "We're losing flight attendants. We're losing them. They're losing their jobs because of their disease. We're losing them because they're dying. I got to do something. I got to help them." So I went to Alaska, and I said, "I'd like to start a program with flight attendants who are struggling with the disease of alcohol and drugs." And they said, "Well, we'll get back with you." So they got back with me, and now they send me over to corporate to talk to HR and everyone, and an attorney, a lawyer's in the office. And I sat down and said, "Am I losing my job?" And they said, "No." The lawyer was there to see what type of program I'm talking about. So as of that year, and that was in 2018 as well, we started the Alaska Airlines Drug and Alcohol Affinity Group. And it's a group we meet twice a month to help people who are struggling with alcohol or drugs at Alaska Airlines. As a result of that, it's when you heard Christopher talk about this magazine. And the highest award you can get at Alaska Airlines is a Legend Award. And I was nominated and got the Legend Award that year for reaching out and helping other people at the carrier. They told me, "Chip, you share your story. I have no problem. I was such a secret for a long time. I have no problem in telling you who I am today. I'm a recovering alcoholic and a membership of Alcoholics Anonymous." And so I talk about it. I wear the ring, which leads to my coin, which leads to my story. And we're on a jump seat sitting right here. So that's a captive audience. So I'm always talking. And if they ask me, I'm going to tell them about my recovery program. And they said, "Chip, I was 18 years at the time. Over the 18 years, you don't know how many flight attendants' lives you saved. They've been coming into our offices asking for help because they flew with you." And I go, "What?" And I know of one. And I said, "Really?" And they said, "Yeah." My supervisor said, "We want to give you this award, this prestigious award." Who would have thunk an alcoholic with 3 DUIs, tens of thousands of dollars in debt at the time, would get the highest award that the airline could give me? Who would have thunk someone with 3 DUIs with tons of fees and attorneys and court costs could be standing in front of y'all today? I know who thunk. And that's my higher power, who I give honor to every time I open up my mouth. Because I know that higher power is the one that's doing. I'm just breathing. That's all I'm doing is breathing. I get excited. Everyone, I get emotional. I get excited at the same time. I'm like a whirlwind. But I enjoy this program so much. And when I have the opportunity to share, it just gives me even more energy. And you know, and I don't run with the people I used to before. I run with the people in recovery, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't run with the people I used to before. I run with the flight attendants who are in recovery with Alcoholics Anonymous and the other employees. And that's what the airline told me. They said, we don't want you just to help employees who are flight attendants. We want you to help everybody on the Alaska payroll. I go, what? So that was the higher power. I'll leave with this. There's a story in here called Crossing the River of Denial. And I love what she says. So here I am, sober, successful, serene, just a few of the gifts of the program for surrendering, suiting up, and showing up for life every day. Good days and bad days, reality is a wild ride, and I wouldn't miss it for the world. I don't question how this program works. I trust in my God, stay involved in AA service, go to lots of meetings, work with others, and practice the principles of these steps to the best of my willingness each day. I don't know which one of these keeps me sober, and I'm not going about to try to find out. It's worked for quite a few days now, so I think I'll try it again tomorrow. And that's what I have to do. I wake up in the morning, just activate my recovery. And if that means holding the door for someone, if that means saying yes to speak at an engagement, if that means just being nice today and not kicking people off a plane because they didn't say good morning when I said good morning back. And I used to do that in my first year of recovery. My sponsor sat me down and says, that's not recovery, son. You don't get mad at people and throw them off a plane sober. He goes, that's not recovery. He told me, bring my literature. Christopher is one of my sponsees. All the guys have their literature. We're known for that in the South End. If you see this, they're like, you're one of Chip's. But it's because my sponsor told me, you went to college? And I said, yes. What'd you take? I said, I took my literature. I took my books and pens and paper. Well, every time you go to a meeting, carry your literature. You're still getting learned. You still got to learn. Carry it everywhere you go. And it stays in my car, and I travel with a smaller version because now that phone we talked about earlier, it's not a dumb phone anymore. It's a smartphone. It finds meetings, and it has an app, and I go to them when I'm on my layover. So I appreciate y'all allowing us to speak tonight, and it's always an honor to be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just thrilled. Now I'm so happy. But thanks for y'all hearing my story, and thanks for letting me share. Thanks.